Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 59 of Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I'm your host, Josh Nason, writer, editor, podcaster for the site, former writer for Fight Magazine, Bloody Elbow, Bleacher Report, and a bunch of other sites that no longer exist, coming to you somewhat live from an undisclosed location somewhere in Seacoast, New Hampshire, but one that's not too hard to find. Hopefully you guys are having a great start to your 2017, recover from New Year's, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, all that. And also celebrating my birthday. That was this past week. I haven't seen a lot of gifts show up my doorstep yet, so maybe they're just delayed or something. So if you guys are sending those off to me, I haven't got them yet. 39 years old. It's, coming up on the big 4-0. But, you know, if you ever want to remember how old I am, just think of how old Tom Brady is, New England Patriots quarterback. Very similar, very handsome guys, both very tall New England champions. He's clean shaven, and I'm not, but you get the comparisons there. So if you're wondering, scratching your head, scratching your chin, wondering how old is Josh, just always think of Tom Brady, because we're the same age and cut from a very similar cloth, other than the, deflating thing, but we'll skip that for another time. Let's see. Q2, we're talking about 2016 still. And again, my apologies for getting the show out a little bit late. Scheduling issues, blah, blah, blah. You don't need to hear about that. The show is here. So Q2, talking about April, May, and June in 2016, and we got a great recruit to discuss this, a former JNPO guest, John Nash. He of BloodyElbow.com, doing some great work there. He joined me for about an hour and 20 minutes. There was a lot to get to. So we went through all the whole months. Conor McGregor, obviously, coming up. We had a little bit of Ronda Rousey news, but obviously we talked about some of these big events, UFC 199, which... If once you hear what we talk about, there's a reason it was my favorite event of the year, because everything around it was an event. The fights themselves, the news coming out of that, the fact Ariel Helwani, MMAfighting.com got banned, and the whole thing leading out of that. It was just a fun weekend of the sport. Michael Bisping winning the title. I think it was my favorite event of the entire year of 2016. But there was just so many different results and things that happened, and unfortunately, guys passing away. You had Kimbo Slice, Muhammad Ali, you had Ryan Jimmo and Jordan Parsons dying during this time as well. So it was the highs and the lows of the sport in this three-month stretch. And I think you guys are really going to enjoy this conversation. John and I went again for about an hour and 20 minutes, just two guys just talking about all this stuff, going through headlines, and I hope you guys really enjoy it. So buckle in. Hope that you're driving. Turn the radio up, sit back, relax, drink that coffee. Or if you're at home, wherever you are, enjoy this conversation. We'll talk to you after the interview. Let's give it up for John Nash of BloodyElbow.com. So we are continuing our look, even though we're back in or currently in 2017. We're kind of just wrapping up our 2016 year in review coverage, and we're taking a look at Q2, getting all businessy, the second 3 months of the year, as it were, April, May, and June. And doing that is someone we had on the show a long time ago, and we're glad he is back. He is a intrepid reporter, investigative journalist of sorts, and doing some great work over at Bloody Elbow. We welcome the one and only John Nash back to the show. And John, we'll start you out with the really easy stuff first. Is how was your 2016?
Fairly uneventful, which is not that great, I guess. but it was okay. Can't complain. You know.
Uneventful is good. That not every year has to be full of crazy shit going on,
Yeah, but it's also kind of dull and boring. So,
well, here's hoping that your 2017 is full of wild nights, Hunter S. Thompson-esque stuff. We'll hope for that.
Well, I can't hope for that. I'm too old for that. So, but at least a little bit more.
You are never too old for a convertible ride through the desert. Trust me, never too old for that. So we are going to talk about April, May, and June. And for those that listened to our first show with Paul Fontaine, the format here is pretty easy. So I go through the Bloody Elbow archives every year, and I go through every single month and kind of headline by headline, try to pick out kind of what the biggest stories are of the month and kind of pick out the top two or three. Then I run through some of the other kind of bigger notable headlines of the month. And this isn't every single thing that happened, or else the show would be, hours and hours long, but kind of the big stuff to give you a flavor of what happened throughout the year. And what's always amazing is, we look back at these and there's so much stuff that just happens and that we forget about. We're like, oh yeah, that was weird. And in this 2016, this was like the craziest year for MMA news and events and championships changing and all that. So even though we're going to talk about kind of a 3-month span, I did want to ask you, John, what, like, out of the whole year, what stood out to you when you look back at this year, what stands out to you the most?
I think the overarching, if I had like an overarching, like a grand theory that combined everything, I think the UFC sale stood out the most to me. Like how kind of it tied with UFC 200. It was obviously planned to go coincide with 200. And it also fell in place with all the fighters when they started hearing the numbers coming, how they started asking for more. So that was almost like a giant rock thrown in the middle of the pond that was 2016. And it cast ripples everywhere else. That was the one that stood out to me more than anything else.
I would agree. Yeah, certainly was a massive story and something that is going to continue to extend, obviously, into 2017. Still, there's so much that we don't know, and that's part of the intrigue of it and the frustration of it and just the, you know, this big giant question mark, because we still simply don't know a lot about these new owners and what they want to do. We know kind of about them, but we don't really know what their intentions are. And I have a feeling by the end of I'd say maybe even by the middle of 2017, we're going to know a little bit more just by their actions and kind of see how things go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we're getting a sort of a sense with the way they're booking and stuff. And you look at those, what we know from their business with the deal, how it was structured, that they have some high hopes for big earnings by the middle of next year. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Interesting and a major challenge nonetheless, but let's start with April and we'll kind of go for what, this was a wild few days, and this whole thing, obviously, it was kind of the year of McGregor in so many different ways. And if you kind of look at this everything that happened, so UFC 200 was planned, obviously, for the summer. It did obviously happen. But the original fight was going to be Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz, the rematch. And then all of a sudden, this whole kind of weirdness starts happening with, you know, Conor McGregor, he was pulled from the event because he didn't want to do a press conference. There was this whole thing about how we found out he was training in Iceland at the time, didn't want to come over to New York to do a presser. He said he would do a New York one or a Las Vegas one rather later on. And this whole question of, was it a money thing going on? And, you know, was he trying to hold them up? Was there just, it was this giant like question marks around this whole thing that one of their biggest stars, all of a sudden they just pulled him from what it was expected to be, you know, one of their biggest events of the year. Within a couple of days, he said, you know, he still wanted to fight in the show and that UFC was refusing to put him on the show. They were saying, of course, that he wasn't going to fight. He would later tweet that he was back on UFC 200. This was like Conor's, like, his Twitter renaissance or his Twitter, like, this is like, he talked about, you know, he retired. That was like a big thing. And this whole, like, just whole thing about Conor, UFC 200, how it happened, what we learned afterwards, the whole Dana White thing, and just the fact that basically everyone seemed to be kind of in agreement that, big deal, he missed a press conference, no big whoop, you know, let's have this fight back on. And Dana really and the UFC stuck their guns and did not have him on the show. And eventually, I guess it kind of worked out for the best with 202. But this was just a wild story with McGregor really starting to test the UFC and the UFC, you know, pushing back a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's first in context in it, in the sense that there was some background information. I remember Jeremy Botter talked about around UFC 189 that there was some friction between the UFC and Conor McGregor. And a lot of people laughed at that or said that it's not true. And maybe, I don't know if Botter used the right term. I don't think McGregor's like hostile to the UFC, but obviously from talking, there's some friction there because McGregor, he's a guy that wants to make as much. He's a mercenary. He wants to make as much as possible. So there's that friction obviously playing between the UFC and McGregor. There's also the fact that he just lost to Nate Diaz. So here's a guy that made three huge pay-per-views in a row, his first three, each one doing better than the last. And then he lost. And so there's a lot of pressure on him to get his mojo back because a second loss to Nate Diaz maybe cripple his drawing power, what his plans were. And so you could understand his point of view that he wanted to set on training. So they have this power play by both sides. McGregor demonstrated how popular he was by having this massively retweeted tweet. at the same time, he was kind of powerless because they, you know, they could yank him from the card. I think it was a demonstration of the UFC that as big as you are, as valuable as you are, you're just another cog in the machine. Mm. And I think that's kind of the end result is it didn't hurt McGregor in the sense they booked him for 202, but for all of his actions, and he ended up kind of being the winner because he came back and won a 202 and demonstrated how big a draw he could be there. For all of his actions, he really didn't have any leverage to force the UFC to comply with what he wanted, which was give him some leniency on his schedule.
Connor, the whole Connor versus UFC thing, one of the fascinating things, you mentioned how big, you know, the tweet was about retiring and everything, was that mainstream media, sports media, picked up on this as well, right? I mean, they were very interested in this, and, you know, this was kind of like the... It's interesting where ESPN and so on chooses to kind of really focus in on MMA and UFC and when they decide to kind of back off from it. But they were really into this. And this was kind of Connor had a huge year when it comes to, you know, pop culture wise or sports culture wise. And this was like, people really seemed to kind of take notice. And it was just, I don't know if it was just this tweet or just the whole thing around this, but they really seemed to take interest in this really, really weird macabre story.
Yeah, it was the first demonstration, I think, of Connor as mainstream star, because he was big before. They did big numbers at 189, and you saw this huge Irish crowd come out. They did bigger numbers at 194, and he started seeing some mainstream press. But basically, after the loss to the Nate Diaz, and I think where the mainstream saw the attention to that fight, it elevated McGregor. Even in loss, it elevated him to the wide mainstream appeal. And it elevated Nate Diaz. I mean, Nate Diaz became a superstar after that fight. Conor McGregor became a mega superstar.
Yeah, yeah.
And which shows how big Conor is, that he elevated Nate Diaz to that level by beating him.
And then within a few days, of course, the big question is, okay, what's the main event of UFC 200 going to be? You're taking off this big thing. And later on in the month, we got our answer that Jon Jones versus Daniel Cormier 2 was going to be our official headliner. So obviously there was a little bit, I don't want to say a little bit of a drop off, but there was the fact they were able to slide in this main event that eventually obviously wouldn't happen, but that, you know, Jones and Cormier, they were going to finally have this rematch that was pushed off. And, you know, again, you lose a little bit, but then you're able to kind of pick that momentum right back up. And the fact that we knew at some point we were going to get McGregor Diaz too, it seemed like this major issue with the UFC ended up, as we kind of alluded to, ended up later being a nice windfall for them, because they got not just one big pay-per-view, but they got two within like a 2 months time.
Yeah, I mean, Cormier Jones is a big fight. I guess there just wasn't you could tell there wasn't the excitement, and that was almost the first sign that 200 was kind of not going to be as big as people imagined, because you remember, even earlier, the talk was to be Connor would be in a fight and Ronda Rousey would be coming back to fight Holly Holm or something like that. That there was going to have this huge doubleheader.
Yep.
And it's weird because Cormier Jones is one of the biggest fights UFC could book, and yet people still felt a little unenthusiastic for it for 200. It didn't, for a lot of people, it didn't feel big enough for an event that it was supposed to be the mega event of the year.
So
that was a nice one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I mentioned Cormier and Jones, and earlier that month, we're obviously supposed to get this, supposed to get this fight at UFC 197, and the light heavyweight champion of the world, Daniel Cormier, got hurt. He was out with a leg injury, and all of a sudden he was pulled out of the title rematch with Jon Jones. And there was a question of whether, you know, could Jon Jones fight on short notice? And there was just, you know, Stipe Miocic's name got thrown in that mix, and it was kind of it's always funny when, you know, you have a big name fight and you have one superstar that's still in it, like Jones. And all of a sudden, you know, like we saw with when Rafael Dos Anjos got pulled out of his fight, all these names kind of got thrown in, right? Everyone's kind of looking for a money grab, opportunity, all that stuff. We saw it eventually 200 with Anderson Silva stepping in against Daniel Cormier. And Jon Jones was like, okay, is this going to be time he fights at heavyweight? They need a main event. And a day later, after DC Jones was scrapped, no one expected this, I don't think. Ovin St. Preux, out of all the fighters on the roster, was slotted in the main event against Jon Jones. And we had the interim light heavyweight title, the first time that had happened in, I believe, 13 years. This is going back to like the Liddell Couture days. The interim light heavyweight title was created, and that fight was made. And the reason that Dana White gave that the interim title was needed, John Jones never lost his title in the cage. That was the promotional kind of pull for that. So we had one big fight off, and again, later would be rebooked. But then we had John Jones fighting for an interim light heavyweight title against Ovince St. Preux. What do you remember about when that whole situation went down?
Well, I mean, I was a little confused by it. It didn't seem necessary to have an interim title. I mean, one thing, I mean, there's always question marks with the UFC and MMA and Hall because there's sometimes other reasons they do stuff. Like the interim title for Jones, it's possible they wanted an interim title for the match because they could promote it better. It's possible that, you know, they thought, well, if we make Jones, we want him to be a champ, so when he fights Cormier, it's a bigger champion versus champion. But it's also possible it's some contractual issue where, you know, Jones has in his contract that if he has a title, he gets pay-per-view points. And he's, you know, he's like, I need to be in title fights, otherwise I don't collect those pay-per-view points. And so they threw him the interim belt because if he has a belt around him at that point, then every fight going forward, if Daniel gets hurt again or whatever, every fight he gets, at least he has some sort of pay-per-view points coming in. So there's always weird stuff like that. The other weird thought that came to me after that is I really wanted to see him against a heavyweight at that time. I thought that had been really interesting. And if you look at the new owners and how much they're much more interested in spectacle compared to what UFC had the machine to keep the tournament system they had going, you know, continuing to put the number 2, 3, 4, and 5 fighter against each other. With William Morris, I wonder if they would have just done a heavyweight fight against Jones if they were the owners back then.
That's a great point. Yeah, if that same situation happened today, I think you might be right. I think they might try to go for the more the spectacle and more the what's going to draw a little bit more on pay-per-view, obviously, because they need this revenue as opposed to maybe giving a guy like OSP a chance against, you know, Lucky Shot and one of your not necessarily a huge pay-per-view draw on Jones, but a guy that is a bigger name in the sport goes down. You don't want to hurt that. Yeah, that's a great point. I wonder if that situation happened now, would they go that heavyweight route and just say, listen, we want more of the newsworthiness and the kind of the spectacle of it rather than the sportsmanship? That's a great question.
Yeah, well, we'll find out. I think it's going to, a similar situation will spring up at some point this year, then we'll get our answer.
Great point. UFC 197, that we talked about that. Obviously, this John Jones fight and the DC injury came on short notice and kind of why they had to scramble, put things together. We saw that event, and Jones obviously winning the interim light heavyweight title, being OSP. This was Jones' first fight back in, I believe, it was about a year. And it was, there was some rust there. The fight wasn't really that good. It was kind of boring. I think people were kind of hoping that the momentum that that Jones would blitz OSP and have one of these, you know, convincing kind of walk-off wins. You think about some of the past just impressive performances, but he was, I don't say wasn't the same, but he was not the Jones that we really are that familiar with and that comfortable seeing, I guess, in the cage. But he beats OSP for the interim gold, and then obviously we're kind of, there's no more barriers between him and Daniel Cormier 2. Of course, that would change later on. Also on the show, we had the flyweight champion Demetrius Johnson continuing his campaign towards this amazing record of title defenses in a row, taking out Olympic gold medalist Henry Cejudo in the first round. And also on the show, Edson Barboza just pretty well dominating Anthony Pettis. So it was an interesting night for a lot of those fights. Obviously, the Jones story was the biggest stuff. But you also had some kind of other interesting stuff on there, not necessarily blockbuster wise, but nice kind of footnotes for what was a card that had a lot of issues going into it, and again forced to make this interim light heavyweight title fight on just a day's notice, a couple days notice rather.
Yeah, for the one that got me when I watched that night, I remember was Mighty Mouse. I thought that was a star making performance, considering he had a lot of great finishes in his last few fights, and that was the one that was he just blitzed Cejudo, and I was really impressed. I thought, okay, this is the one that with a large audience he might be captivated to a bigger star. It didn't really happen, but in a weird way I do think Mighty Mouse is almost written off too much as not a star, like he's not a draw. I think what we've seen with him is he's kind of like a boxing star on HBO where hardcore fans will tune in for him, But he's not the type of appealing fan that's going to get big pay-per-view buys or big ratings on TV. In fact, it's maybe in the future when the UFC gets more on Fight Pass going, he's the type of guy that's going to get people, though, to subscribe to Fight Pass, because the hardcore fans are going to, the guys that are really die-hard and seeing who's the best, which, you know, might only be 50,000 to 100,000, but that's a sizable amount of money, are going to make sure they would subscribe to make sure they got his fights. So he always struck me as he has that kind of really dedicated hardcore fan following now in MMA, because he's proven almost to be the best in the league, or I should say best in the sport. But he just has not transcended into mainstream wider appeal.
Yeah.
Even after like that.
Yeah. And I think the rest of the division also doesn't do him any favors as well. There's just, I've talked about this before, in that he's, you know, he's so good. I think, going into this, I had said that I was hoping Cejudo would get another year before this shot, just because I think he could have been, you know, could he, I want to say he was rushed into it, but there really just, there wasn't any guys left. You didn't really want to do the Benavidez, another match against Benavidez right away. And there just wasn't a lot of other contenders to kind of put in there. Cejudo was kind of, you know, undefeated at the time, and he was, you know, just, he was like the only guy left. There was something there. Obviously, you could, the Olympic gold medal, you know, well-spoken, all this type of stuff, speaks two languages. But there, he just, I think most people would agree, he wasn't, I would like this, he wasn't fully ready for this as he might have been a year from now, had he had, a year from that shot, had he got in, you know, a few more fights, and I don't want to say tune-up fights, but just ways to kind of sharpen his skills and build a little bit more momentum. And he, you know, we'll see. He'll eventually probably will get a shot again, just because it seems like the flyweight title, there's just rematch after rematch after rematch, because, you know, just because Johnson needs guys to fight, he just, the rest of the division can't seem to gel and catch up like you see with some of these other divisions, like Bantamweight, for example.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. I think he should have got another year of, I mean, it was one of those things that felt like he was rushed, and you'd almost like to see more of a boxing model with him where they let him develop and work on different types of opponents, and because he just was thrown into the deep, I mean, way into the deep end on that fight, as good as he is. I mean, and the other bad thing, too, for, I always thought for Mighty Mouse, Ian McCall could never string together a couple wins after their first fight.
Yep.
Because there's a guy that had some, he has, Ian McCall has charisma for that weight class, you know, American, a personality, a look, and he has a history with Demetrius, and I thought that could have been kind of a someone that could Demetrius could build his name off of, because people would be interested in McCall. Like, you need recognizable opponents for a champ to build his name on, and if you know, they're not, he's not quite getting that.
Mm. We'll go through the rest of the month and see if there's any things that kind of stood out to you as we get through this, and so many random things that happened. Yoel Romero's suspension from USADA got reduced down to less than 9 months. That was obviously a big kind of story going into that whole thing. The Tough format was announced, the next season of Tough, and speaking of Demetrius Johnson, he was announced he was going to defend against the winner of Tough in December. They had tryouts, and then all of a sudden they canceled the tryouts, and a lot of people didn't really know. We really know what was going on with it. We obviously later find out the whole format, but at the time, it was kind of this big head-scratcher. Rampage versus Satoshi Ishii was booked for Bellator's second Dynamite show, their next effort, their latest effort at putting together MMA and kickboxing. We learned that Dada 5000 suffered two heart attacks in that unfortunate fight against Kimbo Slice. UFC 200 started to get a few more fights on the card with Misha Tate versus Amanda Nunes, and then Juliana Penny versus Kat Zingano, so we started to see that card develop a little bit more. Frank Mir failed for a USADA violation, if you remember that. He alluded to kangaroo meat as a possible reason that he failed that test. We got UFC in Croatia. Junior Dos Santos returning, dominating Ben Rothwell. And we also, speaking of other heavyweights, Derek Lewis just knocking out Gabriel Gonzaga cold and continuing his march towards some bigger and better things. The Ali Act for MMA started to get a little bit more momentum or a little bit more discussion around that. Unfortunately, we had a death in the cage, not in the octagon, but in the cage over in Ireland. This was one of those that kind of, I think people, as they kind of learned a little bit more about it, were a little bit more struck by it, perhaps because Conor McGregor was kind of tied into it, being, I believe, as a teammate, or he was there involved. Yoel Carvalho had died in Ireland following a TKO loss in a regional show. That was kind of a big thing.
Yep, and there's also possibility, too, that happened right before his tweet, and there was some conversation that his actual retirement was real, because that's McGregor I'm talking about. McGregor really was going to retire because the death was affecting him so much.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot all about that. Yeah, that's right. BJ Penn returning or booked to return against Dennis Seaver for UFC 199, and that was seen as pretty good at the time because not a main event, not a co-main event, just kind of something on the card. I believe it's going to be on the FS1 portion of the show. Kind of a low-impact return, but obviously that would not happen. We learned that Chuck Liddell and Forrest Griffin were going to come back to coach Tough Latin America 3, which nobody but the hardcores watched. George St. Pierre confirming his negotiation to return to the UFC and admitted that the Reebok deal was getting in the way. Obviously, he was an Under Armour guy. Speaking of Reebok, it was announced they were going to add color to the UFC uniform. So, yeah, obviously, changing the game there. Not so much. Lyoto Machida admitted to using a banned substance. Substance we learned really did not have does not really that much impact on the body and really shouldn't be kind of like flagged or really part of USADA's protocol. He admitted to it on a form. He was out of his rematch against Dan Henderson at this much maligned UFC and Fox 19 show because later Tony Ferguson would be hurt and he was out of the big fight with Khabib Nurmagomedov on that show, and Khabib got the relatively unknown Daryl Horcher instead. UFC 199 started to get a little bit more filled up with Dan Henderson. Obviously, he needed a fight, and he was booked up against Hector Lombard. Joe Benavidez announced he was leaving Team Alpha Male. Speaking of Fight Pass, Fedor Emelianenko, of all people, has announced he is going to be fighting on Fight Pass for a Russian-based promotion against Fabio Maldonado. There was all this talk around Fedor, obviously this quote-unquote high probability that he was going to eventually come to the UFC. Obviously, that didn't happen. Rafael Dos Anjos, then lightweight champion, booked against Eddie Alvarez for Fight Pass leading into that big international fight week. UFC on Fox 19, the show we just mentioned, Glover Teixeira, an injury replacement, knocking out Rashad Evans. We finally got the, after MMA being legalized, or UFC announced for November, or about to be announced, rather, their November 12th show at Madison Square Garden. Talking about that and talking about kind of the big names that are going to be on that show, Dana White said that Ronda Rousey at the time was likely for New York City and that she'd be probably fighting for the title in her return. Obviously, that would change. Vanderlei Silva was booked for the Rising Grand Prix. We turn our eyes to Bellator. Benson Henderson announced he was going to go into the U.S. military. At some point, he made his anticipated Bellator debut at 153. And then managed to get dominated by Andrei Koreshkov in the welterweight title fight. Just a really one-sided fight in a lot of ways and a big eye-opener for a lot of people that thought that Henderson was just going to go in there and dominate being from the UFC. That was not the case. Bellator booked the London show for the O2 headlined by Kimbo Slice versus James Colossus Thompson. And finally, we were supposed to get Paul Daly versus Josh Koscheck, the rematch in the co-main event. They booked their, they got some blowback for booking their inaugural featherweight, women's featherweight title fight on the undercard of a show instead of actually on the main show. This is going to be between Marlos Kunin and Julia Budd. And then due to injuries, that fight never happened. We're still waiting for that. UFC announced they were going to have their first women's flyweight fight in company history in an upcoming show in Ottawa. LeVar Johnson was sentenced to 5 years after a very brutal assault on his girlfriend. Terrible story there. John Fitch won the World Series of Fighting welterweight championship. WSOF opened up a New York office. And also, they eventually resolved this issue with Ali Abdelaziz, this whole like agent thing. It was a big mess. But the Nevada State Athletic Commission saying that everything was resolved and eventually he would leave the company. And that was April. What rest of those headlines stand out to you that you remember?
Well, I mean, one was the Machida drug test failure, which USADA failure, which in hindsight, I mean, when you find the details, you look into the substance and you look at how he got sentenced, I think 18 months his suspensions for.
Yes.
Compared to I guess you'll talk in a future episode about Brock Lesnar and John Jones, but they got a year. The substance Machida was tested for, I can't remember off the top of my head what it is, but I remember it's a supplement that was added by USADA only 2 years ago, and there's a lot of questions if it's even offers any enhancement, performance enhancement. So it seemed like it was drastic overkill that he got punished for that. And he self-reported it, too, if I remember right.
He did.
So on every front, it seems like that was overkill and unfair that at his age, his career almost seems like it's over. And that's the one that stuck out the most to me. That, and then there's a lot of fights that were announced that just weren't that good. But
absolutely. Let's go to May. And May was kind of a, you know, a quiet month in a lot of ways. It was really just kind of the light apps before the big meal that was going to be this amazing summer. And kind of, you know, we go in the cage, UFC 198, this big Brazil show that was just really, you know, stacked from the top down. And I hate that term stacked because I think sometimes people just use that term just kind of loosely. But this show really was from top to bottom. There was intrigue. They were playing the soccer stadium, even though they lost Anderson Silva on this show. They still had a pretty big event, and obviously with just things like the weigh-ins, Matt Brown flipping off the Brazilians. I remember seeing those pictures. That was quite something, and just kind of, you know, the perfect foil to go down there and kind of be the ugly American. And he ended up getting pretty much one-sided beat down by Damian Maia. We had Jacare Souza on that show, just, you know, running through Vitor Belfort with no problem. Cyborg Justino, Lady Cyborg, making her UFC debut, just crushing Leslie Smith. This was kind of a big thing, you know, dropping to 140 pounds, a whole weight cutting issues, all that, but just, you know, beating Leslie Smith and showing that she was going to be someone to watch. And then we had in the main event, the soccer stadium was silenced. Stipe Miocic crushing Fabricio Werdum. You know, we had the whole Joker smile thing leading in this time and time again. Fabricio seemed to be really kind of, you know, I don't want to say overlooking, but he seemed to be just really almost too relaxed going into the show or going into this fight. And Stipe Miocic made him pay, just crushed him and knocked him out and won the UFC heavyweight title. The whole soccer stadium went quiet. And we have someone right now in Miocic, as we sit here, still the champion. We're kind of awaiting his next fight. But in this heavyweight hot potato division when it comes to the title, and it's been this way forever, there's a chance, knock on wood, that we might have a guy that can actually hold the title for more than a couple of defenses.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised. I picked Werdum to kill him, tell you the truth. And that whole event, that event was kind of amazing in many ways. One, I find it interesting because the Brazilian market, just what it says about the Brazilian market, it was almost like a reward of the Brazilian market. They came in and put this, I'm not going to say all the matches were great, but it came in with tons of star power. Some of the guys were, you know, past their prime, who were fighting on that show, but they were all the top name, plenty of the top name Brazilian guys. They brought tons of star power for that show. Packed a stadium. At the same time, the Brazilian market is crumbling because the Brazilian economy just took a tank last year and all the political upheaval. And if you notice, I haven't seen big shows booked in Brazil ever since the sale. Is there? I'm trying to think of one. Has there been one really big show in Brazil since then?
They've announced one for early. Oh, they had it. Well, Cyborg fought in November there.
That was a Fox Sports One show. And
right.
It was her headlining. But I'm thinking about big shows that they had before. There'd be a couple per year, pay-per-views and stuff put in Brazil to bring the champs and the stars down there. I mean, they did Ronda Rousey the year before in Brazil.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, it just seems to me like that market is taking the back burner to them until they figure out what's going on down there. That's one thing I noticed. The other thing about that is, God, there's a lot. One is, I think, you're right about Werdum, I think, overlooking Stipe. I mean, I didn't give Stipe a chance, but I think Verdum's thing, there seemed to be a lot of effort by Werdum that year to turn that show, to turn himself into a star. Remember he bought like 30,000 Werdum faces that they took away from the audience? Like, yeah. There's all this effort him and his team were doing to make himself a known commodity. I think he really came out to put on a show for the people there, and it just backfired.
It certainly did. Yeah, he was taken out in less than 3 minutes.
But the other interesting thing is all these people that talked about Cyborg not being, you know, she couldn't fight in the UFC, she's not a star. There seemed to be almost as much attention to her that week and for her fight than there was for any other, except for Werdum probably, and maybe, you know, Belfort Jacare, but for any of the other male stars in the show. In fact, that fight, that performance, that's what they just, you know, based on that, they decided to book her as the main event in a later show.
Yeah, she was she was third from the top on this. And again, Anderson Silva was supposed to be on the show against Uriah Hall. He had to pull out due to, I think it was gallbladder surgery. But you mentioned the star power and kind of the past your prime power. Again, Vitor Belfort, we all kind of know what was going on there. He's still kind of bring him out, but it seems he's just out there to kind of job to everyone else and try to get some other guys over. Shogun Hua fought on the show against Corey Anderson, kind of a boring fight there. Again, Damian Maia versus Matt Brown was the quote-unquote main event of the prelims. John Lineker actually opened up the FS1 prelims against Rob Font. Little Nog was on the UFC Fight Pass show. So, yeah, it was kind of like a I would say an all-star show, but it was like almost like the past, present, and a little bit of the future for Brazilian MMA when it comes to this. And you're right, yeah, they have not had any major shows there or really planned anything since. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, that's. I mean, we'll wait and see, but it just seems like Brazil. I mean, I know Brazil still was one of their biggest markets. They make over 10 to 15% of their revenue from Brazil. But it just seems that ever since, you know, Brazil had a massive kind of meltdown last year, and maybe the loss of a lot of Brazilian champions, it doesn't seem like they're putting in the effort they did before. Mm. So we'll see what goes there. And, you know, and unfortunately for Cyborg, she failed the test. You know, I'm almost kind of a Machida-like situation again, I think, with her. But, you know, we'll see how long that takes her out of, or maybe it ends her UFC career. We'll have to wait and see on that, too.
Yep, yep. Interesting stuff. And we go into something that wasn't a huge headline, and obviously for, you know, this is really kind of the MMA hardcores, the ones that follow Bellator, that Will Brooks was lightweight champion and looked great in some fights against Michael Chandler, and just really, you know, not a blockbuster or a you know, major headliner, but he was a guy that was obviously, you know, well-respected and kind of learned, you know, talk the talk and all that. And he came kind of a contract impasse with Bellator, won a next fight, and there was just a big discussions about that. They didn't seem too eager to book him anywhere. And they ended up coming to an agreement, and they actually cut their lightweight champion from the promotion, and then they decided to put the belt up in a fight between Michael Chandler and Pitbull, a rematch for the title. Obviously, you know, booked pretty heavily for Michael Chandler to regain that belt, which he did. But this was, you know, the questions that a lot of people, including myself, have about kind of where Bellator is or where they want to go and how they sign free agents and all this and just the glut of shows they have. And, you know, then the roster moves they make are very interesting. And again, this was coming not too far after that, you know, that I won't say disaster of a show, but just spectacle of a show that was, you know, Ken Shamrock and Hoist Gracie and then obviously Kimbo and Dada. And then we talked about the, you know, the two heart attacks and all that stuff. But a guy that they had there in a lightweight champion and someone that was, you know, he didn't miss weight. He did his job. He went in there and won. And they just were like, okay, they worked out a way to simply just release him from the promotion. This was just fascinating from the sporting aspect that they would just simply say, we're good.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, there's a lot going into that too, I think. I mean, I'll go back to Bellator in a second, you know, where I think of him. But for Will Brooks, I guess it was clear that he did not want to re-sign with Bellator. That, in fact, that not only would he not, you know, normally you'd put out the opinion that, oh, when I'm done with my fights, we'll renegotiate. I guess he was putting out the word that he had no interest in re-signing at all. So from that point of view, you can kind of see Bellator's, you know, their kind of their dilemma that, if we book you in a fight and you keep winning, we're just promoting you for no reason because we're not going to get the benefit from that. And there's no, you're not going to come back and sign with us. We might as well just cut the loss and release you. This is interesting too, because this is basically, you know, if you talk to the guys that are pushing the Ali Act, they use Will Brooks as almost a case study of why you need the Ali Act, because he loses all of his value because he doesn't get to retain the championship or his ranking, you know, because it's attached to the promotion. So in that case, it's really interesting too, but it's one of those, to me, is a perfect demonstration of how MMA works, you know, especially non-UFC MMA, that that if they can't promote you themselves and get their money back, the championship really means nothing to them. You know, you look at Strikeforce. I mean, the championships really are tools for promotional devices. And that reminds me of where Bellator, I think, is right now. I think Bellator, I was very critical of Bellator last year, at the beginning of last year, because I didn't even watch the Kimbo Dada fight. I didn't watch the, you know, Shamrock Hoist 3. I just had no interest in those. But they remind me in a weird way of where Strikeforce, Scott Coker's previous promotion, Strikeforce, was when he was booking Bob Sapp versus, what's that guy's name, Jan. Or he was booking Tank Abbott. You know, he was booking these weird freak show fights. Remember that at the beginning of Strikeforce?
Yep, yep.
And that kind of strikes me where, you know, Bellator was, where he was drawing attention with that. But you look at where they are now, maybe the championships, I don't see them booking stuff like the UFC to build divisions and build, you know, title champs that are the best of the division. But what I do see them doing is building a roster of potential headlining stars Some very talented guys, Rory McDonald, he's got Chandler still that they re-signed. They've got, you know, they picked up Benson Henderson. As much as he's been beaten, he's actually built up the roster's value because guys have beaten him to show that they're, you know, that they're worthwhile opponents. He's done all that, and then you add in the, to the mix that they've now got, you know, Tito versus Chael. They got guys like that who are replacing the Shamrock Hoises and the Dadas and Kimbos.
Yeah.
So it's, I feel good in that sense that, you know, maybe it's not true sporting with Bellator. I don't think you can do true sport to compete with the UFC, but they are going much more to they're positioning more to where Strikeforce was later in their run on Showtime.
Yeah, I hope they get, and I've talked this before ad nauseum, is I just hope they get to eventually less shows. Like, I don't need to kind of like coin flip. Do I really need to watch the shows from Windstar Casino in Thackerville, you know, Oklahoma, yeah, or whatever, right? I think with the one thing with Bellator is that I think if they do less shows but more impact shows in having four or five fights a month, and, you know, that progress divisions forward and that their names we kind of know, and there's just so much just flotsam and jetsam when it comes to that, the roster, and they just, some of the guys they just throw out there, just it's not top level stuff that we really should expect to watch. And we hope that because they, people come in and say, watch the Ortizes and Chaels, that they'll kind of stick around and see some of these other young stars and be like, huh, I'm interested in seeing this guy fight again, or this guy fight again, or this is kind of fun. And I just think the way they do it so spread out, and it just, it makes it difficult to really, after a show, you know, if someone watches on a Friday night and a Monday morning, you're like, quick, tell me what happened in Bellator Friday night. I think most people kind of be hard pressed to remember, most MMA fans, unless they really thought about it, be like, what happened in like the opener? What happened in this? What happened in that? And I think that kind of hurts them after a while. It's not, especially in when there's so much, you know, leading into UFC Fight Week or all this other stuff, there's not a lot of talk value there. It kind of just happens in a vortex and it goes away. And there's just not really a lot of implications, I guess, and kind of hooks for the average MMA fan.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that shows you, the dilemma, the problems of being on network television or cable in this case, where you're dependent on ratings compared to Showtime or subscribers. Because Showtime, they had that awesome tool called the Challengers,
yes,
where basically,
yes,
your prelim fighters had their own little card, and ratings didn't matter. But it gave these guys their own show. And because ratings didn't matter, because you had subscribers, you could put on shows that were, you know, not big headliners, but you could do all these extra shows to give guys experience and show up-and-coming fighters, and then you could check that out. It'd be awesome if they did a good division point in Bellator where you had your main shows, which were like your Pride, your big Pride shows they're trying to do, your big old JMA shows, Japanese MMA, and then you had other shows that are development shows. But the problem is you need ratings, so I don't think they ever want to advertise those as the B shows.
Yeah. The Strikeforce Challenger shows were so great. Just so much fun. On late night on Showtime, and they were fun. They were in smaller venues, and yeah, those shows were a lot of fun.
And you got a chance again to focus on a small group of fighters instead of having like a 6-hour day of, you know, 8 prelims. You watch your 5 prelims, and you're like, wait, that guy, you know, that, this, you know, this OSP guy is pretty good. I should check him out. Luke Rockhold, who is this guy? He's a handsome dude. I should check out his next fight.
Yeah. Boy, that'd be one thing I wish that UFC would do in the future is kind of, and I mentioned this when talking about like Mickey Gall and some of these other guys where you just, there's not an obvious next opponent. You don't want to necessarily bring in an unexperienced guy to add to the UFC roster, but it'd be great if they kind of just built up this own separate brand, like, and use Fight Pass to do it. And maybe it's, you know, one of these other smaller groups where you just kind of bring guys in, you loan guys out, they're still under contract, you kind of protect them, but you kind of add some value to watching on Fight Pass. You don't necessarily have to let them develop in the octagon. To me, like, when they get to the UFC, they should be almost as ready as you can be, if that makes sense. Not kind of learning the craft in the cage. I want them to learn as much as they can before and kind of qualify almost to get there. I think that a Challengers-esque event series on a Fight Pass acknowledged by the UFC is kind of branded that way. I think it could be a lot of fun and make a lot of sense for them.
I mean, if they're going to get rid of the Ultimate Fighter, why not put the Ultimate Fighter as more of a promotional, a whole league on Fight Pass?
Yep.
And you have, you know, multiple, you know, that way you could, that's your development league. You could book Ultimate Fighter Latin America, whatever, all over the world still, but it's really, it's a development league, and guys don't disappear. You know, you don't do it. It's not a reality show anymore. It's a never-ending set of shows to develop the next Ultimate Fighter to make the UFC.
Well, I hope our checks are in the mail from WME.
Yeah, I know. Let's call Ari right now and pitch that to him.
I'll text him once we talk about this next subject. UFC, and another thing, not really the sexiest headline, but one I think is important for fighter safety, and one that really we've seen kind of result in a lot more fighters missing weight, was UFC enacting this policy. I believe it started in California, if I have that right. But it was essentially that they were going to go to the, instead of the classic nighttime weigh-ins that we were all very familiar with you know, around, you know, 6 o'clock East Coast Standard Time, or Eastern Standard Time, rather, and people strip down, they miss, blah, blah, blah. They were going to move to the morning weigh-ins. People have this, you know, two-hour block to weigh in, generally between, I believe it's 8 and 10 a.m., and they go and they weigh in, and later on it's more of the ceremonial weigh-ins. The idea that fighters get to spend another day fully rehydrating, this is going to be best for fighter safety, and that people will be able to, you know, fighters will be able to plan better, what have you, and within this two block, they could show up at 8 a.m., they could show up right before 10. As long as it's within that two-hour window, they're fine. And as the year went on, and we see this as guys like, you know, as we finished out the year, Johnny Hendricks and others, and Rob Font, that there was a lot of fighters that simply just still could not do it no matter what. And it's kind of this weird two-hour window now where a lot of people try to get this out of the way, and then you have a few stragglers. And as the hours go on, you kind of feel like the stragglers, like, okay, something's going on here. And immediately there's a lot of suspicion, and certain guys like Kelvin Gastelum don't even bother coming down for the weigh-ins. So it's added another kind of level of intrigue, again, all in the guise of fighter safety. And we can all talk about weight cutting at a different time and the whole safety of that in general. But, you know, this was for a sport and a company that really is very slow to change. This was kind of a nod in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, no, I think there's going to be a lot more changes coming forth with weight cutting, because just from the amount of research being done on, you know, brain damage and health risks from just weight cutting, I think people are starting to realize just how incredibly unhealthy it is. I mean, for years, MMA was basically where, you know, wrestling was, high school and college wrestling was a decade or two ago, where anything went for weight cutting, until people started realizing just how horrible it was. And I think this was the first step. I mean, we also should remember this was after the IV ban, too, so it made weight cutting harder for some guys, because some guys would just dehydrate themselves, you know, completely, and then depend on the IV to punch, you know, to rehydrate with afterwards.
Yeah.
So, I think with, you know, this year, next year, whatever, there's going to be a lot more drastic weight cutting rules put into place. I know the MMAFA, they met with or sent an appeal to the ABC, the Association of Boxing Commissioners, to make a change to the weight classes, because they want to have less separate, you know, 10-pound differences in weight classes, basically add two more weight classes so guys don't have to cut as much. So I think there's a strong possibility, since ABC endorsed that a few years ago, that comes back, and then we start seeing not only new rules on when you can weight cut, but then we start seeing new rules on what weight classes there can be.
And as always, there's probably going to be, while this is obviously for fire safety, I'm sure it's going to be a lot of people that just simply don't understand. They don't get the whole weight cutting thing and why it's dangerous, and are just going to just completely hate it and all that stuff. But again, that's kind of the way that these things go, right? The non-sexy policy, some people pay attention to, other people just do not care. And again, if for a media person, it's fun to, I don't watch every single morning weigh-in, but some of the ones I do, it adds a little wrinkle into this whole process. And then again, once you get to the, you know, the ceremonial weigh-ins, it is quite the walk of shame for these people that miss weight, because you know they missed and they still have to do the whole thing and stripping down. That's the funniest thing with the ceremonial thing. They still always strip down even though they've already made weight. You know, and they still step on a scale. It's the weirdest thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, with the new rule, would we ever have gotten the, that's another question, would we ever have gotten the Gina Carano 7-pound underwear? if, you know, for the young people who don't remember that, she had to strip basically nude to make weight, but apparently her underwear weighed several pounds. That's what they lost when they took that off. So, but I'm waiting to see if someone imitates that, to get attention on the weigh-in, for the fake weigh-in. I didn't make it. I got to take it all off.
Right. If anyone will do it, it will be Filthy Tom Lawler. No doubt about it.
Yeah. I'm not watching that show, though, as much as I like Lawler.
Let's go through the rest of the headlines, and we'll round up with June. World Series of Fighting decided to book a brother versus brother fight with Carlos Fodor versus Ben Fodor, a.k.a. the superhero Phoenix Jones. Robbie Lawler versus Tyron Woodley was set for UFC 201 for Lawler's welterweight title. Tony Ferguson was going to get his, after being hurt, he was going to get his next fight against Michael Chiesa at UFC's debut in South Dakota. And that was, I remember I was looking forward to that fight a lot when that was first announced. Holly Holm returning after her first defeat at the hands, or actually that was not, didn't happen at the time. Holly Holm versus Valentina Shevchenko was booked for UFC on Fox in July. Again, this was Holm's first fight after she got beat by Miesha Tate. And this that fight would obviously turn out to be, a lot of people watched that show, and that's something we'll get to when we get to July. But interestingly enough, Shevchenko's coach and herself were involved in this just incredible, this robbery tempo. They were at a chicken place overseas. And there was, I remember watching the security footage of that, and just this gunman came in. This was just a crazy story. Her coach, I believe, ended up getting shot in the leg, I believe. So this was just a crazy thing. Again, just a short time before this fight, she's actually just happens to be in this place and in this restaurant, and this whole thing goes down. And you never want tragedy, but it's just to come so close to that, it's just so amazing. Paige VanZant, she had quite an interesting month. Wrapped up on Dancing with the Stars, finishing up second, and really just kind of rose, did this whole competition. I don't exactly think it pulled in that many UFC watchers, but it was still kind of an interesting thing to follow. I think I actually watched part of this finale and had no idea what I was watching or the scoring or anything like this, but we were interested in seeing what happened. And then she obviously, during this whole lead-up, revealed she had a little confrontation with Ronda Rousey, and Ronda didn't take kindly to win. PVZ shouted out Holly Holm for her win, thought it was a slight on her, and Ronda kind of turned on her, and this was the latest kind of nod towards Ronda taking things maybe a little bit too seriously, and PVZ not really having that many, it's obviously smaller. It was kind of just a weird situation. The Floyd Mayweather versus Conor McGregor rumors just kept going. Colin Cowherd said it was quote unquote definitely happening in September, if you remember that. UFC Rotterdam, UFC's first event over in the Netherlands. Alistair Overeem, the native son, knocking out teammate Andre Arlovski. Stefan Struve knocking out Bigfoot Silva. We got Arlovski coming back not too soon after that, as he was announced for UFC Hamburg in Germany against Josh Barnett. We started to hear the rumblings and the rumors of a UFC sale. A number of $4 billion was thrown around, which Dana completely denied. And I believe this was at the time he was saying, if it's $4 billion, we can talk. And there's just all these kind of rumors. And again, we're used to rumors in this industry, but this seemed to have a little bit more weight to it. And as with, Jeremy Botter was talking about it and some other people, obviously, it was ended up being a little, true down the road. So it's interesting to see where it started. Joe Rogan said if the UFC sold, he was, quote unquote, 100% gone. That would change quite a bit. We talked about Anderson Silva. He's obviously hurt, having his gallbladder removed. He was out of fight with Uriah Hall at UFC 198. Speaking of people being fight, this is kind of a weird sequence. Dennis Seaver was hurt, and he was out of his fight with BJ Penn at UFC 199. Cole Miller was set to replace him. Then later in the month, BJ Penn decided he was going to pull out of that fight. Actually, not his decision. It was due to a USADA violation for IV use, and we were talking about that earlier. And he had him kind of saying he didn't really understand the whole rules, didn't really like it, and claims he wasn't cheating and just really kind of wasn't up on things. But he was going to be out for some time due to a USADA violation. It was kind of one of those weird headlines when that first came out. Joseph Benavides and Henry Cejudo were booked for the tough finale in December. Speaking of flyweights, Demetrius Johnson was announced he was going to defend his title against Wilson Hayes at UFC 201 in a fight that nobody was really asking for, but we're going to get anyway. Gray Maynard said he was going to drop to 145 pounds in an effort to extend his UFC career. Looking at Bellator, we had Phil Davis edging out King Mo in Bellator to earn a light heavyweight title shot. Jordan Parsons, a really sad story. We first learned he lost his leg after a devastating hit-and-run accident, and later that week dying at just 25 years old. A really sad story and something that affected a lot of people in MMA, teammates, and we'd see some tributes to him throughout the year. And, you know, in a sad year, we lost a lot of people. This is kind of one of those tragic ones where he didn't really get to see him get to the levels that we thought he might, simply because, you know, taken so early on, just 25 years old. Josh Thompson versus Michael Chandler, that fight was scrapped due to a Thompson injury. We're still waiting to see that. Rafael Carvalho and Melvin Manhoff fought for the Bellator middleweight title in possibly the worst fight of the year. This was 25 minutes of complete boredom. The best part about the fight was Twitter at the time, and people just, you know, we were all watching this together and simply just making fun of it in every way possible, hoping that something would happen. And this was quite a fight. And the fact they were going to do a rematch of it is possibly one of the more head-scratching decisions of 2016. We know that Big Nog was going to be heading into the UFC Hall of Fame. Fortunately, Chris Weidman was not going to get his rematch against Luke Rockhold right away. Used to be 199. He was out with an injury. And we learned that Michael Bisping would get a shot on very short notice, and that was obviously lead to some big news there. Jason Mayhem Miller, somehow still fighting, returning for a group in Italy, and missed weight by 24 pounds, and that was a big surprise there. We heard a report that the UFC and Nate Diaz can't come to terms on a rematch with Conor McGregor, and that Dana White, quote-unquote, stormed out of a meeting, and this was kind of interesting stuff. We learned that Stipe Miocic versus Alistair Overeem and Fabricio Werdum versus Ben Rothwell were booked for UFC 203 in the Octagon's debut in Cleveland. And finally, Ultimate Fight Night 88. This is Memorial Day weekend. Brian Caraway beating Aljamain Sterling in a slight upset. Cody Garbrandt just blitzing Thomas Almeida in the main event. We also had Jeremy Stephens defeating Henan Barao on that show as well. And that was May. What stands out to you?
Yeah, well, that was a pretty eventful month, actually. If I remember right, remember Jason Miller, his opponent was Luke Barnett, but he thought he was going to take on Josh Barnett for that. I remember, it's funny, I don't remember the Melvin Manhoff fight at all, even though I watched it. That shows you how bad it was. Mm-hmm. I think I actually fell asleep during it. There was a lot of stuff that month. I remember the Mayweather rumors was good. I wrote an article about that, of how he could actually get out to fight Mayweather. And then next thing you know is McGregor seems to be following the article, although not completely. So I don't buy that he's actually going to fight Mayweather. But I wrote that the first step would be getting a boxing license. And what do you know, him and Nate Diaz both got boxing licenses recently. But they haven't taken the next step. And then, of course, the UFC sale rumors, which that was when you started feeling those first ripples of, fighter unease or discontent, because as soon as those rumors started going up, I noticed fighters were much more willing, at least behind the scenes, to start talking about stuff that they wouldn't talk about before. So that was an eventful month. Good thing that sale never happened.
Good thing. And then we go to June. And speaking of eventful months, this was interesting for a lot of different reasons, and this it kind of definitely hits on all these different aspects of the sport, and we'll start to the aforementioned UFC 199. There were so many fun events in 2016. This was fun for me, and this might be my top event of the year, and even above Madison Square Garden, in terms of just a complete just like the whole night. I remember, I think it was up till about 2:30 or so, following news on Twitter, because we'll talk about what happened. It's just, I love when these, it's the in-cage stuff, but also we get announcements for future shows. And so we're kind of, you know, sitting there in the laptop watching stuff, and we got word that there was some big stuff coming up for UFC 200 and 202. And so let's start with the in-cage, and then we're going to go the out-of-cage first. So UFC 199, obviously this was Michael Bisping coming in, I believe, on 2 weeks' notice, maybe 3 weeks' notice, I believe. And, big underdog against Luke Rockhold. Rockhold had beat him before. This is for the UFC middleweight title. And Bisping, in less than a round, knocks out in Luke Rockhold and takes the title, this coronation of this journey, which nobody, you know, he had been forever without getting a title shot, finally got one. We thought it was almost ceremonial. He's just going out there to collect a paycheck and put in a good effort, but probably get beat. And he became the middleweight champion. And this is something that just is, you know, it was such a feel-good story in a lot of ways. And obviously Bisping had been such a heel in the past. And going back to UFC 100 and tough and everything. And it just kind of came full circle. And he knocked this guy on his ass and a rival of his. And it was a no-doubter. And Michael Bisping, after UFC 199, this was Michael Bisping was your UFC middleweight champion. Unbelievable stuff.
Yeah. No, I think it was 2.5 weeks, 17 days, I think exactly, the announcement. He was booked before. And, I mean, the other thing, too, is Luke Rockhold kicked the crud out of him their previous fight. This was a rematch.
Yeah.
So no one gave Bisping much of a chance. And, you know, nothing against Bisping, but he wasn't. I mean, most people now don't consider him the elite of the middleweight division. I'm sure you did a poll of most hardcore MMA fans or media members or whatever. Luke maybe rates at him still. Yoel Romero, people probably would favor. Chris Weidman, they'd probably favor. There's probably four or five guys they might favor. They probably favor over Bisping. So it's pretty shocking. He won the title in just shocking fashion. Then he beat Dan Henderson and still has the title. I'm hoping he books fights against. I hope he does a catchweight super match versus super fight versus Woodley, so that the title ain't on the line again. And then the fight after that, he can go against Nate Diaz. And then against Bell. You know, every fight and just it almost be like with the Honky Tonk Man back in the late '80s. Kept hanging onto the belt. Everybody would be stacked up behind him, waiting, knowing they could beat him, not getting the chance.
Yeah, he reminds me of a pro wrestling champion that has the title, and you think, oh, he could get beat by like one of 10 guys. Like any given night, he can get beat. Just, you know, put the title on the line. It's almost like if you could, like, you know, get counted out of the ring or something like that. You know, just climbs over the cage, like, I'm done tonight, I'm done. And, like, try to keep this thing and be, like, the longest ring middleweight champion of all time or something.
Well, that was the old standby for the bad guy wrestler of the 80s. Wasn't a tough guy, he was a cheater.
Yeah.
And he would, you know, every match would end with him getting disqualified because that's, you know, Nick Bockwinkel would punch a guy in the eye and choke him until the ref disqualified him, even though he was losing. And, oh, I get to hang on to the belt. Look at that. Ric Flair, famous for that. Bisping is the Ric Flair of the modern era.
That's a pull quote right there, John Nash.
Yeah. Well, or we go Billy Robinson because it's British.
Yeah.
He was a bag for a while, too. So I
should have known, being a Minnesota guy, you'd pull out that Nick Bockwinkel reference at some point.
Yeah, well, you know, Billy Robinson, anybody AWA I'll go with.
That's right. We still have to do that AWA show. I just remembered that. Also on this show, obviously the finale of their trilogy, Dominic Cruz besting Uriah Faber and kind of ending that feud. That was the latest Cruz win over a Team Alpha Male guy. That obviously would change later in the year. Also in the show, this really fun, out of nowhere, crazy finish with Dan Henderson just decimating, crushing Hector Lombard, if you remember that. Max Holloway won again in the show opener. Kind of a blah fight, but obviously his campaign towards doing some big things at featherweight, that kept on. And then we started getting the news. And the news led to other news. And so we got this first thing of Nate Diaz and Conor McGregor, the rematch. Obviously, we just talked about before that was pushed off from UFC 200 as the main event bump. We didn't know if it was going to happen again. There was all this talk about, again, the walkout and all the, you know, Dana trying to negotiate, just getting frustrated and blah, blah, blah. And we learned that it was going to be happening for August. We got a nice little spot there, UFC 202. And the fight was on, the rematch was on. And that was obviously a really big, exciting thing. And then we got word through Ariel Helwani of MMAfighting.com that the Canadian himself, Brock Lesnar, was going to be returning and at UFC 200 against an opponent TBD. And it was like, wow, what? Like, is this amidst all this other fun stuff happening, we hadn't even got to like the main event or co-main or anything like that yet. But this was, we got Diaz McGregor, and all of a sudden Brock Lesnar was coming back. We later learned it was going to be against Mark Hunt. And then we learn, and I believe this was right after the show ended, that Ariel Helwani tweeted that he and his MMA fighting crew of Casey Layden and Esther Lynn had been escorted out of the building for breaking the news of Brock Lesnar. And then this just led to a media mainstream tour for Helwani, I see a lot of people in the industry sticking up for him and trying to kind of figure out what's going on. We got stories of, some rumors, some physical backstage confrontations that he's kind of alluded to and other people have alluded to, and kind of this just thing that anyone in working media should not have to deal with. We led to a emotional appearance from him on the MMA Hour. A lot of revelations about Fox, almost him essentially being a UFC employee in a lot of ways by getting paid by Zuffa for his work on Fox. And we've heard about that time and time again. He's owned up to that. He was on all these different shows. He was on Scott Van Pelt on the ESPN Sports Center. He was on the Dan Patrick Show. He was on some other things. And it was kind of this big thing about them having their credentials removed. It became a media issue and kind of a bigger issue. And what seemed like it was a thing that lasted for a couple weeks, it eventually was just reinstated within a couple days, thanks to public pressure, SB Nation kind of got involved and what have you. But this was this whole UFC 199 media circus story, and just the Bisping win, obviously the Cruz win, the Henderson win, the Diaz McGregor news, Brock Lesnar, it was coming back. That was crazy at the time. And then the whole thing with the most notable and known journalist in sport and media personality, Ariel Helwani, getting kicked out. This was so batshit crazy. I love this. I will take this 10 times out of 10, all this news coming out of this.
Yeah, I was shocked at how much I enjoyed the card. First of all, the fights, I really enjoyed the card. And the Hendo knock on a Lombard was...
awesome.
Was just... I just flipped out. And then think about it, without that win, Hendo doesn't get the title shot against Bisping.
You're right.
So, and then there's a good chance maybe Bisping doesn't still have the title. So there's a lot of repercussions from that. The Ariel Helwani thing was... I was surprised at how much attention it really got. And I guess it shows you, I was great that people stood up for Helwani, and I'm sure he's very thankful for that. But I think it also shows you kind of, you need a very strong media presence, a lot of fame, I guess, or presence that Helwani has, because he's so well known, people stood up for him, because this sounds like I'm regular Helwani, and I'm not, but it just, think of all the guys in MMA that were banned from the UFC.
Yep.
And no one stood up for. I mean, you got Josh Gross, famously. You got Loretta Hunt. You got Jonathan Snowden. It's my understanding, I learned that the whole Bloody Elbow staff is basically banned from going to UFC events, or at least, getting credentialed.
Yeah.
So on that front, it's like, this is so common, and this is the one time that there was such an uproar over it, and I guess a big part too is the fan base, because Helwani has a huge fan base. There was such an uproar over it that it was overturned, that something was done about it.
Yeah, you're right, and it was really the fault, and it still is. I mean, we're obviously recording this the first week of January, that there's still, there's talk about a writers association, media people association, whatever you want to call it, and it was really the fault of all of us that obviously they got reinstated, which is good, and we understand all that. But, Josh Gross still does not have his credentials. Jonathan Snowden still does. It just, we kind of, we just kind of just dropped the ball and not pushing it forward and saying, why aren't these guys credentialed? But there's also the thing of like, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? All these sites going to stop covering UFC? Of course not. Sorry, if Bloody Elbow all of a sudden said they're going to stop covering UFC. That's I used to write for the site. That's the majority of the traffic is because of UFC related stuff. It's not like you can do that. So
the very next day announcement would be the rest of the staff of Bloody Elbow is getting laid off.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a tough position that everyone's in, because what are you supposed to do? Right. You really have to hope like the ESPNs of the world or something like that would say, okay, until this is settled, but they're going to do that for their own guys. They're not going to do this for everyone else. So it's a very weird position, but you're right. Yeah. The cry for someone, obviously him being so well known, that makes sense. Unfortunately, the rest of the group that's still on the outside looking in couldn't have come along for the ride as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the most egregious moment too is that they also supposedly banned the whole MMA fighting staff, and especially Esther Lynn was kicked out. And Casey Lane they had nothing to do with the story, that there were nothing to do with what they're upset about. And it was like, man, talk about vindictive, which I guess if you pay attention to what they did to AKA sounds, exactly up their modus operandi right there.
Yep.
But that might have galvanized people a little bit too. It seems so extreme, but you know, I mean, for I would like to see. I mean, I'm not involved in any writers association thing with the. I'm not off. This is a part-time job for me, but if I would like to see, I mean, one thing a writer association I think could do is they, you know, sure they're not going to all go on strike or not cover the UFC, but they could bring together, coordinate attention to certain subjects, which would bring perhaps enough attention that it would be too embarrassing for promotions to engage in that kind of behavior.
Yeah, that'd be the hope. And I think there's a lot of us are part-time, but I think we come from a place where I think it would be good to have. And I know that there was some discussion about it. Jonathan was on Stone was on a media podcast this week with SI podcast, Richard Deitch. And he had mentioned there was like emails going around. I didn't see any of those, but I think it was kind of done by a separate group, but yeah, I think it'd be good for these type of things. And also kind of help all these younger guys and to look at, to kind of work with the UFC and other organizations and really kind of talk about the UFC, but why, you know, why is the staff of Bloody Elbow banned? Is it just simply because of the commentary and just their knowledge in the space? Well, there's also a lot of good stuff done there. And, you know, investigative journalism has a place, and that's important. If you're not doing anything wrong, then don't worry about how you're being covered, you know? And I think just to ban entire groups, it's very petty, and it's been that way for a long time. And it was kind of just this whole thing of, I remember Dana kind of talking about this stuff afterwards about, you know, they should have let us know and just kind of explaining why they would ban them to begin with. And, you know, he was just doing his job. He got a hot tip. It came out. And I think he said it ruined it for the fans. It didn't ruin anything for the fans one bit. When they aired that ad for UFC 200 and they ended it with all of a sudden Brock's face and he punches the camera, it wasn't like we sat around and said, oh my God, I wish I had known that he was, you know, going to be fighting on the show. And I think we kind of get in our bubble a little bit because there's probably a lot of fans that had no idea that Brock was coming back and they were still thrilled by that. So it's just the whole like rationale was also just, it was such bullshit, you know, it just was.
Yeah. The percentage of fans that are paying attention to what's being on Twitter, or what's being leaked about it, about 10% for watching the event. The majority didn't see it. I don't get that argument. Obviously it just seems there was more to it than that, that they had, you know, this was a chance to give Juani a lesson. Maybe they were fed up, you know, with some other stuff. It's all pretty petty, I'm sure, too, as well. You know, like stop leaking little stuff that we don't want leaked because, you know, they've been known for a long time to be control freaks. But I understand Juani's point of view, did not go to them. Juani's big break, the Strikeforce thing, was basically the UFC one-upping Josh Gross, who was working on that story.
Right.
So you don't, you know, you never, for, if you have confirmation, as much as you should go to people and give them a chance to confirm it, there's a long history of certain people in MMA leaking it to other people to want, you know, to take away your story. So you got to be careful about that. And usually, you know, the trick I do is I have my story ready to go and I give them a very limited amount of time. Like, you try to find another reporter in 2 hours to write some on this.
Yeah, I understood. Yeah, and that's exactly the case. And interesting stuff there. We have going to another story with the month of kind of going to the – we talked about a year full of tragic deaths. And really, with 2016 with celebrities, it was a lot of deaths. And this was somebody that transformed – not transformed, but really transcended – both pop culture and mixed martial arts. And I think sometimes we even lost perspective of how big he was outside of fighting. I remember friends asking me after I heard this news and just they were kind of, you see on stuff on Facebook and kind of lamenting his death, but these are not people that followed MMA at all. Kimbo Slice passing away at just age 42. We'd soon later learn due to congestive heart failure. And this was something that just kind of, you know, we heard he was rushed to the hospital and kind of following this along as these stories progress. And, you know, Kimbo was, he was a big ratings draw for Bellator. He was, you know, this UFC run he had on Ultimate Fighter. Still remember, obviously, one of the highest rated episodes of the show when he fought Roy Nelson. This was a taped show and still did great numbers for UFC. He was a known commodity even after that, the fight he lost against Seth Petruzzelli. Jared Cook or whatever, screaming at ringside, and Scala, the rapper, right?
And Jared Shaw's son.
Jared Shaw.
I mean, Gary Shaw's son, Jared.
Right. But he was just this interesting guy that, You thought he was gone. He did the boxing thing for a while. I remember seeing clips of him fighting in some, you know, casino in Oklahoma or something like that against a complete tomato can. You think, okay, maybe the boxing thing might happen to some extent. That never really happened. And he found his way back to Bellator and fought in a couple freak show fights. We mentioned the Dada fight, and he was a character, someone that was willing to embrace it. He wasn't, he didn't shy away from cameras. He knew he was a character with the beard and the bald head and just the great physique and all that stuff. And just, tragedy, but just, it was really sad when he died. It was kind of this weird thing of like, wow, Kimbo Slice is dead at just age 42. Just didn't seem to compute. And to this point, it still kind of feels weird.
Yeah, it was shocking. I was surprised by it. I mean, Bellator got a lot of, criticism for booking him against Dada, especially after Kimbo died, because Dada, almost died in the cage too. In hindsight, that fight looked worse. I give Bellator something of a pass for that. First, I didn't watch the fight, but second is, the real criticism. No one was really criticizing Dada versus Kimbo for its health risk. They were criticizing Hoist versus Shamrock because it was two very old men. Kimbo and Dada was being criticized for its talent level. I remember that going into that fight. But in hindsight, it made it look worse. I mean, there's a lot of questions left unanswered. A lot of people want to put the blame on Bellator, but the truth is Bellator doesn't run physicals. The promotion doesn't do that. That's what the athletic commissions do. But a lot of us in the media have been, petitioning, we've been petitioning the Texas Athletic Commission, or actually their department of, I can't remember what they're called right now, the Texas Department of Licensing. They have a different name than an athletic commission.
Yeah.
But we've been petitioning them to get medical access or reports on Kimbo, and they've been basically giving us nothing. I know Steve Morocco and me and Paul Gift and Mark Raimondo, all of us have been asking at least different questions, and they're not sharing anything, apparently for whatever reasons, I guess privacy reasons, even though he passed away. Same with I tried to find out information from his fight in Missouri. I didn't get anything on that. So there's a lot of questions about, should people have known, especially the athletic commissions and the doctors that gave him, cleared him for a pass to fight, should they have known that there was something wrong with his heart? And I guess we still don't know the answer to that. But it, makes it extra sad.
And you allude to it. Can you imagine if one or two of those guys had died in that fight? I mean, I don't know where we'd be. I don't think the sport would shut down. I just to think of how close we were and how easily it could have been prevented if it had happened. It's wild to think about that we almost had one death in there, and then conceivably there could have been another. It's crazy to think about.
It's definitely the end of Bellator. I mean, in a weird way, it might be the end of almost any MMA besides UFC on TV.
Yeah. Yep. It's crazy how close that sport can come. Just one lack of a heartbeat, just one surge of energy that all of a sudden knocks that heart out. And just, everything changes forever. It is. They dodged a bullet there, but unfortunately, Kimbo Slice dead at just age 42. And obviously, we get to another massive, bigger death that month. We'll talk about him in a minute with Muhammad Ali. And finally, this, I put this kind of in what stood out in the month, and there was a lot of newsworthy things in the month. And really, this, what we're learning here about leading into UFC 200, obviously, the announcement Brock Lesnar was coming back, Mark Hunt. How did the whole USADA thing work? There's supposed to be this this mandatory testing period before a fighter comes back, and just the question of retired fighters, returning fighters, all this type of thing. And we learned that the UFC had waived the 4-month USADA mandatory testing period ahead of his return, clearing him for such a short notice comeback. Just about, I think it was a month and a half, something like that. But this is this raised a lot of questions about, the showman versus the sportsman aspect of it. And, Brock's a huge guy, and he's obviously a pro wrestler. There's so, questions. There's going to be questions no matter what regarding Brock Lesnar. But the fact that they decided to waive this period and didn't really have a great answer as to why, this raised a lot of questions about the whole process. And I think people still wonder about this whole USADA-UFC relationship and how people decide to get tested and – You know, Cyborg decides to her testing seems to increase after she does it outside the lines thing. It's just a kind of a weird thing that a lot of us really don't know a lot about and still have a lot of questions about. But this is another kind of big spotlight on just this very unique relationship between the UFC's drug testing agency of choice and their athletes.
Yeah, this is one of those things. This is kind of like the Kimbo Dada thing for Bellator, where technically you did nothing wrong, but by appearances it looks bad. And for Bellator was the idea of these two guys that probably shouldn't have been fighting, and maybe that's an athletic commission's responsibility to check their physicals, but it looks bad for you that you're the one, you know, putting on the fight. In this case, it's the UFC has a rule that, you know, they can waive it. And their argument was, well, we just signed him now, and we want him for the UFC 200 because we don't really have a strong enough card. And so we have to give him this 30 days, but we're going to test him a lot. What kind of made it look bad is, one, spoiler for your next episode, he failed his test. And the other thing that looked bad is there were rumors that right after, whatever WrestleMania they were on, right after he started training for this fight, that he knew he was going to go to UFC 200.
Yeah.
And so that raises questions. It just by appearances, maybe the UFC didn't do anything wrong, maybe they didn't know anything, but by appearances, for a guy to be leaving a sport famous for, performance-enhancing drugs, to then take 2 months of training without being tested before he starts being tested, it just by appearances, it looks bad.
And it also opens up the door for other, they could easily say for other fighters, again, GSP, this came up with potentially could he come back to fight at Madison Square Garden when we started. I think he entered the program again in September, I think, maybe it was August. And it was like, okay, is it going to be enough time before, people expect him to fight at MSG, then was Toronto. Is it going to leave enough time to actually do those testing, and why, would they waive that for him? And just the whole thing when these things happen, it opens up the door for why can't fighter X do this? And again, we talk about fighter unions and why does this fighter get preferential treatment here? And again, there's without a lot of media access to the top brass, it's tough to understand any of this because we really can't ask a lot of questions. And without a union, you can't ask questions. And it's just one of those kind of weird things that it's just really, UFC being UFC in so many ways, and the sport being still not clean in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think we'll have to change it because just if you put on your tinfoil hat and start coming up with the conspiracies that they could do, you can come up with a lot of very reasonable conspiracies where you're trying to help a guy, skip the test. If a big star wants to come back, part of the negotiating process will be, well, you can only announce the fight a month before I come back because, I don't want to be tested before that. And then the guy could retire again 6 months later, come back again. I mean, you could come up with scenarios where you're basically protecting certain star fighters or older fighters where they could be using stuff in their off season. They could have an off season where no one else has it. I'm not saying they ever do that. I'm just saying you can come up with scenarios that seem very plausible with those rules if they want to take advantage of them.
And again, we talk about this, but there's still, the fighters care about this stuff, especially Mark Hunt, who was furious after this fight. And some fans care, media care, but really, I think majority of fans probably don't give a shit about this. And they're like, who cares about Brock testing and all this stuff? Well, we just want to see him fight again. And that's
I think most fans, you could arm them with flails and maces and they'd be happy.
Very true. Very true. And I think that's the thing kind of, they're weighing against, like, do the right thing for, ethics or do the right thing for pay-per-view. And that's kind of weighed out here for that ban being waived. Okay, let's go the rest of the month. And obviously the couple nuggets in here could have made our top three. Speaking of Brock Lesnar, we learned he got his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu blue belt, of all things. Way to go, Brock. Bob Meyerowitz was tabbed for the UFC Hall of Fame as a contributor. Don Frye was also announced that he was going to be going in as well. I believe they're the Pioneers wing, if I remember that right. Ronda Rousey, we hadn't heard that much, but we did learn that she was moving to trademark the phrase, Rowdy Ronda Rousey is in the house. I'll let you wear that put that in a t-shirt sometime and wear that around town. We learned that, unfortunately, she was not going to be returning at the UFC's big show, Madison Square Garden in November because of a knee surgery. That was unfortunate and obviously kind of left us wondering, all right, if Conor's fighting in August, Ronda's out, What's going to headline that show? It's kind of what's happening there. Dana White confirmed that he did indeed storm out of a meeting with Nate Diaz. We're talking about the McGregor rematch. Obviously, the fight got made. Non-MMA, but still notable, Muhammad Ali passing away at 74 years old. And again, you kind of pair this with the Kimbo thing. Pop culture-wise, fighting-wise, obviously Muhammad Ali, a huge pop culture figure around the world. Not to, you know, Kimbo Slice can't hold a candle to him, but it was interesting, these two guys that hit these two different audiences completely for two completely different reasons. It was kind of fascinating when you look back at the month. Josh Koscheck, a big surprise, injured out of his Bellator tilt with Paul Daly, the rematch due to injury. This is just a few days after Kimbo passed away. Again, I mentioned before that he was scheduled headline against James Thompson at this Bellator London show. So not only did their main event go away, their co-main event went away, so they were scrambling for some stuff at UFC London. Anthony Pettis really kind of looking to restart his career in a sense after getting beat again by Edson Barboza at lightweight. He decided he was going to drop to 145 pounds and it was later announced he was going to fight against Charles Oliveira in August. Robbie Lawler, McGregor fight, I love this quote, said he would quote-unquote take his soul if the two would ever to fight. I remember that clip being sent around the internet quite a bit. Chris Weidman got successful neck surgery and his timetable return was still kind of unknown. UFC announced they were going to be heading to Utah for a show headlined by Yair Rodriguez versus Alex Caceres. Such a FS1 show, you can't make that stuff up. Speaking of USADA, Tim Means decided he was going to accept a 6-month suspension, again, with some tainted supplements and all that. Chad Mendez surprisingly flagged by USADA, and he said he was not going to fight the ban, that he made a mistake. We'd soon learn he was going to be out of the sport for 2 years. In a very weird political year, Donald Trump said he wanted Dana White to speak at the Republican National Convention. UFC decided they were going to hire a lobbying firm to oppose the Ali Act spreading to mixed martial arts. And obviously with Donald Trump in office, it looks like the Ali Act probably will not spread to MMA, but that remains to be seen. We talked about Will Brooks. UFC decided to sign him, and he was scheduled to fight a month later against Ross Pearson in July. Bids, talking about the UFC sale, we started getting more reports that bids were expected to be submitted, and that two groups were indeed expected to bid $4 billion. So these rumors that we heard the month before ended up being a little bit more weight to them. GSP, it seemed like every month throughout the year, said he was interested in fighting here, interested in fighting there, even though Dana White said he was not interested in coming back. He started talking about Michael Bisping, so again, now he's looking at 185 pounds in addition 270 pounds. Alex Gustafson, remember him, light heavyweight contender. He said he was finally set to return in September against Jan Blachowicz on a show overseas. Fedor, again, kept teasing a UFC signing. However, he fought in a show, EFN 50, that Fight Pass show we're talking about. He eked by Fabio Maldonado via decision. This was a very controversial fight because he really should have lost. The fight should have been called off at least twice. Big controversy. It was one of those things that I think was like on a weekday afternoon. And I remember just people just going crazy on Twitter about it. And then you watch this thing. It's just like, my God, how did he stand? How did he survive this? The fight was eventually, the decision was overturned. But this was a pretty clear sign that if Fabio Maldonado can knock you around, probably the UFC isn't going to be the best place for you in the future. Bellator, that combination kickboxing MMA show, kind of a boring show in the main event when it came to Rampage Jackson returning, being Satoshi Ishii in just a snoozer of a fight. Michael Chandler simply destroying Patricky Pitbull to reclaim the lightweight title. And Matt Mitrione back after his Bellator debut, returning with a big knockout win, kind of continuing his campaign towards hopefully a title shot, even though no one really knows what's going on with the Bellator heavyweight title. Eduardo Dantas became the Bellator bantamweight champion again with a big win over Makhachev Scalvo. Anthony Rumble Johnson was injured and out of his UFC on Fox 20 fight against Glover Teixeira. Glover later pulled out of that fight, so that was completely off that show. UFC Ottawa, you know, you talk about Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and Rory McDonald earlier. Stephen Wonderboy Thompson edging out Rory in what was going to be his last UFC fight before free agency. Also on the show, Donald Cerrone defeated Pat Chakotay by TKO. We had a really fun fight between two guys that, you know, not really necessarily known for, going to be title contenders or anything like that, but they had an excellent fight at light heavyweight, something that I'm sure they'll feel the effects of later on, their late 40s and 50s. Steve Bossy beating Sean O'Connell, what was really one of the fights of the year, and something you didn't really expect, was just a complete barn burner fight, one of those definitely instant rewatches if you have Fight Pass. We got a report that Zuffa had accepted a $4.2 billion bid by WME IMG. We'd soon later that was confirmed. Obviously, that was big, but it was just we all these questions about this. And Dana White and UFC kept denying stuff. I remember he started going after Darren Rovell about a lot of things. But obviously, that would turn out to be true later on in the year. And the weird kind of this this constant social media build between John Jones and DC for their eventual rematch that would not happen, but the build towards it was obviously happening. John Jones decided he had a big problem with John McCarthy being referee for that fight. UFC announced they were going to return to Manila in the fall. CM Punk finally going to get his first debut or his first action in the UFC, first action in MMA in September against at UFC 203 against Mickey Gall. Paige Van Zandt said she was going to return to action and fight Beck Rawlings at a Fox show in August. She decided to turn down an appearance at SummerSlam for WWE and also roll in the kickboxer reboot because she wanted to focus on training. Again, we talk about sad deaths throughout the year. Ryan Jimmo was dead following a hit and run, just 34 years old. Another sad story. And one of these guys, a Canadian guy, fought in the UFC, had some notable wins, but also a lot of kind of boring fights, whatever. But it's sad he was dead after a hit and run, just 34 years old. Just a really tragic year for a lot of these younger guys in the sport. BJ Penn, again, we remember we talked about USADA, the IVs, all that stuff. He was suspended for just 6 months for the IV use. UFC 202 started to kind of fill out a little bit more. We got Donald, obviously we talked about this before, Rumble versus Glover, Cowboy versus Rick Story. Carlos Condo was booked for his return, taking on Damian Maia at UFC 202. So that card kind of gets a little bit more full, and obviously there are going to be some changes later on down the road with that. Tony Ferguson, it was announced he was going to battle the debuting Landon Venata at UFC South Dakota as there was an injury, as an injury replacement. That fight would turn out to be a lot of fun, and we get to know a lot about Landon Venata. And finally, the one and only Sage Northcutt signed a deal with Reebok, making a lot of people mad. So it was a very interesting month with the month of June. What from those headlines stuck out to you?
Well, not in order of importance to me, but Bob Meyerowitz getting into the Hall of Fame. It didn't, when you haven't put Art Davies in yet, and even Campbell McLaren, that doesn't make sense to me. He was not the most important guy, the founding of the UFC. There were several people that you could have ranked ahead of him that deserved into the UFC Hall of Fame. I'm guessing that was a reward for selling the UFC to Zuffa. And then the death of Muhammad Ali obviously was monstrous. It was probably the biggest celebrity death of the year, even bigger than David Bowie or Prince or Antonin Scalia even, you know, or Supreme Court Justice. He was a huge, huge iconic figure. I mean, I don't think young people might not realize. I'm a little older than most MMA fans, but I watched his damn cartoon in the 70s. They had a cartoon about the guy. He had a comic book. He fought Superman. He was a monster figure, not just in sports, but even in politics. Remember, he went off to Iraq to try to free hostages. He just did a lot of, you know, he was just a massively important man, and he was an MMA fighter. Let's not forget Ali versus Inoki. If you're not familiar with that, there's a great book by Josh Gross that came out last year about that fight. So he was one of the first, I guess not the first MMA fighters, that's been going on for a long time, but one of the first of the modern era of mainstream MMA matches he took part in. The Ali Act lobbying is somewhat I find interesting just because the UFC, that the amount of money they actually spent, if you look at just the lobbying efforts they spent, it doesn't seem like they spent a lot. You look at the year, they spent a couple hundred thousand, but then you realize Zuffa, Stage Casinos, the Fertittas, each gave something like $500,000 to the GOP for their Senate re-elections, which are obviously all, you know, based on doing something about the Ali Act. So we'll see if that money is well spent or not going forward. Their opponents, the fighters that are, you know, lobbying for the Ali Act, I believe their budget's like $30 in gas. So it's a great one too. You know, it's an even fight there on that front.
Yeah.
And then last for me was the saddest story that, you know, one of the saddest stories of the year was the death of Ryan Jimmo. He was a fighter I actually spoke to quite a bit. Both him and Josh Simone, who died later in the year, kind of hit me because those are two guys that were, as fighters, you know, I didn't publicize it, but they're two of my better sources where I would communicate with them, you know, on background a lot about what was going on with fighters and their opinions on when things would happen. I have a group of fighters I will text when some news comes and get their opinions. And those were two guys that I spoke to at length about certain subjects. And so I knew him. You know, I spoke to him a bit. And it was a sad news to hear about his passing.
Yeah. It was one of those years where, yeah, it's these guys that, again, weren't major stars that passed away. Obviously, you know, Kimbo was standing, but you had these guys. It was, you heard these stories and you're just like, God, another one? Like, it was one of those years where that type of stuff seemed to just kind of happen every couple months, and to have some stuff kind of happen back to back like that, it was head scratching. Yeah, it was just kind of just one of these things like, wow, what is going on this year? It's just crazy stuff.
And him and Brock Parsons, too, were mostly basic, you know, homicides, you know, murders. Brock was hit side of the road by a guy, what, drunk driver speeding, and by all accounts, Ryan Jimmo was ran over in a parking lot by some, you know, I guess, you know, only proper way to refer to the guy, some asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was one of those, yeah, definitely easily preventable and really sad stuff. And we saw obviously the table being set for what was going to be a very eventful, July, August, September. We'll get to that in our next episode with Dave Doyle of MMA Fighting, but we'll call it good here. We've been on the phone for about an hour, 20 minutes or so, and appreciate the time. Before I let you go, I'll give you the chance to obviously plug social media, any stuff that you can talk about coming up with on Bloody Elbow. Feel free to break exclusives here on the show, and I'll throw the microphone to you, Nick Bockwinkel style, and the floor is yours.
All right, listener, you cretinous humanoids. I can't do Nick Bockwinkel. No one can do Nick Bockwinkel. But anyway, I write at Bloody Elbow. My Twitter account is at Hey Not the Face. If you want to follow me on Twitter for Bloody Elbow, I have a back end of stories that backed up because I was trapped somewhere where I had no internet connection. It was terrible for the holidays. So I have a bunch of stories coming out, and we are working on Bloody Elbow. We have a video series about where we're going to go through the history. We actually have possibly more than one video series where we go through the history of mixed martial arts, starting with UFC 1 and then working forward for people that might not be familiar with that history, and then possibly another one where we actually start even further back to get us up to UFC number 1. We don't have a name for the series yet, though, so if anybody has a suggestion, throw it my way. Just bear in mind that anything referring to the history of MMA has probably already been trademark, so we have to come with something else. So that's my plans for the year.
Well, that's sounds like a busy year ahead, and yeah, I'm interested in that video series. And yeah, despite not being credentialed, Bloody Elbow always kind of trying to do some interesting stuff, and you always see, just as I was kind of going through the archives and seeing, you know, names of stuff come up and different videos and columns and things like that, just always just different stuff coming up. It's a much different alley when it comes to MMA coverage. And again, I used to write for them a long time ago, and it was just a different way of covering the sport. And I think it's very welcome in today's MMA media.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're proud of our coverage. I think the best compliment we've gotten is when I've heard from several people in the MMA business when we contact them, they tell us that we're the last site they want to hear from.
I used to get that as well. Good stuff. Well, we wish you a great 2017 and beyond, and we look forward to talking to you at some point later this year. John Nash, thanks so much for joining Josh Jason's Punch-Out and recapping Q2 of 2016.
Thanks for having me on, and enjoy the music.
All right, big thanks to John Nash. You can follow him on Twitter. Obviously, read his work at Bloody Elbow. Let him know you heard him on the show. Certainly appreciate that. So many things that happened this year. Oh my God! This is such a fun series to go through, and we're not done yet. And I guarantee you're not going to have to wait a week or 2 weeks before the next one, because it's already recorded. It's in the can. It's waiting to go. So Dave Doyle from MMAfighting.com is my guest for Q3. So that show will be coming out just a day or so after this one. And that was a lot of fun as well. Just that three-month stretch between July, August, September, so many things happened. Those were Connor's months, obviously UFC 202. That was a lot of fun. And I keep saying a lot of fun. Just these years are just, there was so much like bad stuff and crap going on in the world and people complaining and blah, blah, blah. It's really nice that if you're a UFC fan and MMA fan, I assume you guys are if you're listening to this, that you could just like turn the TV and there was just interesting fights and news and all this stuff. It's just a really fun sport to cover. So hopefully you're enjoying the series. I'm enjoying doing it. The research is long and these conversations are long, but is all worth it to help kind of document this amazing year that was 2016. So with that, you guys have been great with your time. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. Thank you to John Nash. We'll be back with you in a couple days with Dave Doyle of MMAfighting.com talking about Q3 of 2016, and then a very special guest coming up for Q4 if I can confirm their schedule. So that'll be coming out shortly as well. Again, you guys are great making this happen. This has been Josh Nason's Punch Out, and until next time, insert catchphrase here.